Before I continue with the teaching I've been giving you, I would like to interject where this teaching is coming from. It is possible that some of you already know that, then it is a reminder. And if you don't know it, it may be important to know it. After the Buddha's Parinibbana, the first great council of arahants took place 3 months later. And at that time, his teaching was sort of systemized and put into somewhat of an order, because naturally, while he was alive, he was teaching according to the occasion which arose, very often in answer to questions. And at that time, religious teaching was always an oral transmission. So it was orally transmitted from him to his disciples. And at the first great council of arahants, Ananda, who had been his attendant for 25 years, recited the suttas, the discourses. Upali recited the Vinaya, the rules of the order of monks and nuns. And while they were reciting, the discourses were put in a sort of an order, long ones, middle-length ones, numbered ones, and thematic ones. Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Anguttara Nikaya, and Samyutta Nikaya. Nikaya means collection. Majjhima is middle, Digha is long, Samyutta is thematic, Anguttara is numbered. 4 of this, 5 of that, and so on. There are approximately 17,500 discourses of the Buddha which were transmitted. About 100 years later, the Second Council of Arahants took place. The reason was that they were called together, that there were differences of opinion as usual, particularly about the Vinaya, the rules of the order. And some bhikkhus said this, and some bhikkhus said that. Nowhere ever are on these occasions any nuns mentioned, although they must have still existed at that time. So in that second council, 100 years later, differences of opinion arose, and different schools arose because of that. There was already a split, a schism in the Sangha. And out of that arose the need to finalize one day the whole of this transmission, so that there wouldn't be all these differences of opinion. Of course, it didn't help at all, but the idea was that this would help. So 250 years later, after his Parinibbana, the third great council of arahants took place. Now, at that time, there were 3 disciples of Ananda, Moggallana, and Sariputta, still alive, one each. These were the 3 great disciples of the Buddha. One the attendant, and Moggallana and Sariputta, I think you're pronouncing their names differently in Sanskrit, were the right-hand and left-hand disciple of the Buddha, and one each disciple was still alive.
Each of them, or they were alive still then? Mm-hmm. So, Sariputra, Moggallana were alive, or their disciples were alive?
Disciples. They were over 100 years old, of course, But the tradition says that these three were there, which would help to authenticate that what was written down at that time was really what the Buddha said. Now, it was written down in what is today Sri Lanka, then Ceylon. Pali has no alphabet. It was written down in Sinhalese, in the Pali language, but in the Sinhalese alphabet. Now, if we want to read Pali, we can read it in the Roman alphabet. There is no alphabet for the language. At that time, King Asoka, the great Buddhist king of India, had sent his son, the Venerable Mahinda, to Ceylon to bring Buddhism to Ceylon. And the king of Ceylon at that time readily adopted it, and the bhikkhus of Ceylon took it upon themselves, there were many bhikkhus very quickly after Mahinda came, took it upon themselves to write down this Pali canon that we call the Pali canon. It was called the Tipitaka. T is three, Pitaka is basket. It's called the Three Baskets, and this is its real name. And the reason for that is that it was written down on ola leaves. And the ola leaves are not like books, but they were being carried around in baskets. And in three different ones. One for suttas, one for Vinaya, and one for Abhidhamma. So they were being kept apart. To this day, there are a few pages of the original ola leaves to be found in Ceylon. They are being kept in airtight compartment, and if one is very lucky, one is able to get a glimpse. They're of course crumbling and falling to bits. However, every year since that time, the bhikkhus of Sri Lanka have copied on ola leaves the original ola leaves, because naturally ola leaves crumble and fall apart. And in this tradition, one has of course printed it in books also, but it is a matter of pride for the bhikkhus of the monastery where Mahinda first preached on a rock to copy the original ola leaves year after year, so that there's always an ola leaf containing the whole Tipitaka available. And they're being kept in cupboards, walls and walls of cupboards, as many of them as they can keep, so that I have seen about 300 years worth of ola leaves. I think before that they have all crumbled to bits. Now, from the time that this was done in Sri Lanka, which was approximately 250 BC, the written transmission has always been supported and helped by the oral transmission. You know yourselves that reading a book is not the same as hearing something. So the oral transmission, particularly for a spiritual practice, is extremely important. And the oral transmission from 250 BC until today has gone on from arahant to disciple and continues on today. You can, for instance, think about that there have always been arahants in the jungle forests of Sri Lanka, here and there, dotted here and there. And even today, we can find them. When you hear this, what I'm teaching you, this is an oral transmission. And in order to get the benefit of an oral transmission, one needs to listen with heart and mind. We've got both of them. We've got to use them. The mind alone conceptualizes. The heart opens up to hear the meaning behind the word. Each word is a concept. If the mind alone does it, each concept can be twisted totally out of shape. We have minds that are magicians, and we are perfectly capable of twisting everything out of shape. The teaching of the Buddha is like an enormous map showing a vast landscape. And it has a beginning and end, this map, namely a roadway, how to get from here to there. It was his unique gift and also his instruction that this map should be offered and made available to anyone who wants it. Naturally, having not traversed the whole of the map, one cannot possibly know whether that which is ahead of oneself is true or not. There's only one way of approaching that which one has not experienced, and that is by opening up heart and mind and hearing whether the truth is there in the heart. One can hear that. If one can't, then the conceptual thinking and the logical conclusions will twist the whole thing any which way one wants it. And when one twists it and turns it, one has no benefit whatsoever. This is one of the greatest jewels humanity has, a teaching that old and that true and tried. It's been tried over and over again and has brought the same results to everyone who's tried it. Naturally, there are other schools that have developed. They developed 100 years after, before even 100 years, after the Buddha's Parinibbana. This happens always when the spiritual master is no longer there that holds it together. And they are using some of their own teachers, great teachers, instructions. There's nothing wrong with that. What we have, however, are the original words. And these original words are the basis for all schools. And the oral transmission is the main way of gaining access to something which is so overpoweringly effective in changing dukkha to sukha. And one should be very careful to really find that access to it in the heart. It is not only the practice. The Buddha said, pariyati patipati, study and practice. So it is the knowing of the words which give us the direction, and it is then adhering to the word with open heart and mind and doing it. Naturally, it's much easier to say it than to do it. And it takes much less time to say it. Because within the scope of these 7 days, including tonight's talk, I will have told you one of the most effective discourses of the Buddha, how to go from dukkha to liberation. Can we do it in 7 days? The Buddha said we can. In the Satipatthana Sutta, which is possibly the most well-known sutta that has been transmitted to us, this is the sutta on the foundations of mindfulness. Sati is mindfulness. Patana are the foundations. The Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha says, if one practices mindfulness for 7 years, one will definitely have the result either of arahantship or non-returner. And then he said, nay, not even for 7 years, 6 years, 5 years, 4 years, 3 years, 2 years, 1 year. Even for 11 months, 10 months, 9 months, 8 months, 7 months, 6 months, 5 months, 4 months, 3 months, 2 months, 1 month. Then he said, nay, even for 7 days. But that means mindfulness in its completion, perfection. Practicing mindfulness in its perfection brings one to the result that this practice is to bring, as he says, in 7 days. It's unusual, to say the least, to do it in 7 days. But it is possible to explain it in 7 days. And that explanation is nothing else except a practice path. And the practice path contains everything that is needed to gain liberation. One time there is a story in the canon about the Buddha taking a walk with the monks in the forest and picking up a handful of leaves and saying to the monks, monks, what is greater, the leaves on the trees or the leaves in my hand? And the monks said, well, sir, the leaves on the trees are, of course, far greater than what you have in your hand. And the Buddha said, that's right. What I have taught you is like the leaves in my hand, but it is perfectly sufficient to attain liberation. It can be expressed even in so short a period as this, as we have been here. Of course, the Buddha expressed it in 45 years of teaching, from the age of 35 to the age of 80 when he died. But what he expressed in those 45 years was very often a repetition. It's not that all suttas bring a totally new aspect. They're very often repetitive, because he wasn't talking to the same people twice. He was always talking to somebody else. The authenticity of the Tipitaka can be seen in one aspect which I find most interesting, namely that in the suttas, most of them, the names of the people who were present are mentioned, the place where the sutta was being taught, and very often these people come back many times, and their qualities and character is described so that one gets to know them a little. In fact, there are several people mentioned in the Pali Canon with whom one can actually feel as if one knows them. They're so well described. The suttas all start out with the words evam me sutam, which means, thus have I heard. And this is Ananda speaking at the first great council of Arahants. And after he has said, thus have I heard, he goes on to say where he has heard it and who else was there to hear it. The name, the mention of the names of the people who were there was meant to be an assurance that he is telling it right, that he's not making mistakes. Because those people could be asked then and say, well, you know, what this fellow is saying, is that correct? So this is one way of assuring the correctness of what is being said and then later on written down. It is very important to feel in oneself an enormous surge of gratitude and joy to be one of the few very privileged people on this earth who are able to hear the oral transmission of the Buddha's teaching, the Satcha Dhamma, the true Dhamma, considering the fact that there are 4 or more billion people on this planet, how many have the opportunity to hear this Dhamma? The karma that we have made must have been able to bring us to that point. The joy and gratitude should be the two factors which make it possible to open one's heart to the teaching. The mind alone won't do it. It never has done it and never will do it. Meditation is always connected with the experience, and the experience always generates from the feeling. This is, I think, an important aspect of where the transcendental dependent arising comes from, which is one of the discourses of the Digha Nikaya, the long collection, and has a history of great importance. There is another tradition in this transmission, a tradition of simplicity. The Buddha himself was a prince and lived what was in those days in great luxury, and found that all the indulgences which he was being offered and the luxury in which he lived did not bring him happiness. Now that aspect of it can be compared to our Western society. We have usually all the luxuries and indulgences that are available anywhere. He didn't feel that this brought him the true understanding of reality. So then, when he left the palace, he became an ascetic and mortified his body for 6 years. That too didn't bring the desired result. So he then, after having become enlightened, said that neither indulgence nor asceticism are the right way. It should be the middle path. The middle path always to be one of simplicity, the necessities, but nothing more. And this simplicity also reaches out into the teaching. There is very little in this tradition of any specific ritual concerned with teaching. In fact, there's none concerned with teaching. And there are no instructions of using any elaborations other than the bare necessity, how to get from here to there. Naturally, far more can be said than what can be said in 7 days, because instructions are far more than that. But this particular sutta, which I choose quite deliberately to teach you, because this is a monastic community and should be able to get the greatest benefit from a sutta which is so direct and contains all the aspects that are needed. Besides that, there would be many other instructions that the Buddha gave, but there is a limit to what one can talk about. This particular one has a content which is suitable for this environment, because it contains also the ultimate reality, to which we haven't come yet. Again and again, all his suttas, bar none, are graduated teaching. all of them. There is not a single sutta to be found where he doesn't start out with our ordinary experience, just like this one starts out with dukkha, which is our ordinary everyday experience, whether we know it or not. And where he gradually gives the instructions how to gain access to liberation, to freedom. The Karaniya Metta Sutta, which is a very well-known one, the Loving Kindness Sutta, starts out with states of mind that we all have and know, and ends up with liberation. I could give many examples, but it's not useful because I cannot discuss all these suttas. This is an aspect of the teaching which shows us quite clearly that these suttas, which we have in our transmission, have been said and given by the same person. They all have that same graduation in it. They all have that same aspect of starting with where we're at and going to where we'd like to be. And giving the instructions very often in a very terse and pithy manner. At times, so short and lacking in a detail that the people who heard it went to Sariputta and asked him for elaboration. This is very often found in the canon also, that the original sutta is given by the Buddha, the elaboration by Sariputta. Sariputta was known as the monk with the greatest wisdom and the greatest ability to analyze. And very often, at the end of the sutta, we can find that the people listened to everything Sariputta said and then went back to the Buddha to find out whether it was really so. And the Buddha always supported what Sariputta had said. The Buddha often, especially in later years, did that. And one could possibly imagine that either the questioners were people where he thought that they might not yet have the open heart for the Dhamma, or that he had been getting ill and tired. No matter how ill or tired he was in his later years, he taught every single day. And that in itself, I think, is a remarkable feat, at least from where I stand. To continue with the transcendental dependent arriving, I should like to go backtrack a little bit and just recapitulate that it told us about three states of being. First one, dukkha, which we all have, and the arousing of faith, and thereby the joy which is possible to have. The joy which I have just described as the gratitude and happiness which can arise in one when one realizes that one has the good fortune to be able to listen to true Dhamma. That joy. And then the meditative steps, from the first to the eighth absorption, meditative absorptions, rupa and arupa jhanas. And from then on, the path to insight. Now, naturally, in this progression, we can see that the meditative absorption, or the meditation as such, is meant to be a precondition for insight. Because the meditative mind, the mind that has become calm and collected is a kind of mind which can attain insight. The discursive, excited, aggressive, worried, problematic mind cannot possibly get near to insight. It is concerned with whatever it contains. Now, our minds can contain anything once we become master of the situation. We don't have to allow it any longer to contain negativities. However, the meditation precedes the insight. Now, if the meditation has come to the meditative absorptions, the states of insight, which I described last night, are automatic and natural progression. It's a natural understanding that one sees the impermanence of all that has arisen, and it's a natural understanding that one sees that there is nobody there when there is a base of infinite consciousness or something of that order. However, we have already discussed that this path that is taught can also be trodden without the meditative absorptions, with momentary and neighborhood concentration, which eventually will also culminate in a meditative absorption. A path moment, which I will describe later tonight, has to be a jhanic moment. However, when the mind does not have that concentration ability, nor the wish to, it can still get insight, such as I described. But that is when, where I stopped last night, terror can arrive, and usually does. It is a step on this insight path, which does not happen to people who go into the absorptions. A mind which is totally happy, totally peaceful, totally expandable, will not be able to experience terror. However, the mind that has not done that, but has concerned itself with insight, will experience terror. And it is a very important step on this insight path. Very often, the person who experiences it, well, feels first of all frightened by it, and secondly, can be induced to stop the practice by this terror, or feels that something is wrong with them because they've heard all about these wonderful states that are possible and everything is one and the mind completely empty and all these wonderful things, and there all of a sudden terror arises. It is natural. It's a natural progression. The Buddha's great gift of teaching lay in the fact of analysis, step-by-step progression, each step known, each step possible to take. If we don't know what we're doing, we're not going to get very far with it, because whatever it is that we don't know about, we either going to turn our back on it or we're going to sit in front of it puzzled. So this is a step and needs to be accepted as such, because at that time the mind has seen the dissolution of all that arises, whether it is mind or matter. Mind or matter in Pali are called nama rupa. The word nama is our English word, the namer, that what names. When the mind is contacted, it starts naming. And rupa is all materiality, all corporality, but primarily, of course, body. So having seen that all this dissolves in the meditation and out of the meditation, Because in the meditation, no thought can be kept. It disappears. The breath disappears. The body, even in concentrated meditation, disappears. Where is everything? Where am I? Nothing to hang on to. What am I doing this for? I thought I was going to get some happiness out of it. And all of a sudden, all I'm getting is terror. And the person would like to step backward, back to a situation where it looked far more pleasant, the whole thing. But it's not possible. We cannot step back from insight. Having had it, we've got it. So stepping back from the terror is not possible. We can always step forward. So the next step, after having experienced the terror, is to look at that which terrorizes one quite clearly, and one sees that it is what are called all formations. Now here the word sankharas is used, which usually we use for thought or for karma formations, but it means all formations. Everything that arises is giving us terror because we cannot find this person that is trying so hard to get on this spiritual path and gain insight and gain liberation. We can't find that person. It's nowhere to be found. It's disappearing, dissolving also. So when we see that, we can get a very, very clear idea of the dangerous aspect of all formations. Namely, that there is danger in them, that everything that is formed, that exists, therefore, brings danger with it, not only because it dissolves all the time, but because it's constantly having an impeding quality. Yesterday I used the example of this house. It constantly has an impeding quality. It impedes on one's thought, on one's actions, on one's time, on one's energy, on one's abilities. Everything that exists produces dukkha because of the fact that it has the aspect of arising, disappearing, having to be looked after. The impeding quality which everything has, which means that it has some way of getting at us, also has the quality of signifying, which means the mind has to do something about it. Now we might in the first instance think, oh yes, the danger lies in rupa, in corporality, in having body, in having these material aspects. But there's no danger in mind. It's all right. That's maybe the first aspect of understanding. But when we investigate this a little further, we can experience the fact that the mind is not excluded from this, because the mind has to constantly respond to everything that is happening. So it's also constantly under pressure. The mind's under pressure, the body's under pressure. And then people say, oh, I'm feeling pressured, I'm feeling tense, I'm feeling that I'm being that there's more asked of me than I can actually accomplish. Well, naturally, the pressure that is there is constant because of all that comes at us, and we've all been experiencing this for years on end, but we've always thought we could get out of it some way, going somewhere else. Dukkha is forgotten, or at least it is covered over by moving. So we think that we can get out of this pressure that is being put on us. But when we see quite clearly, after having had sufficient insight, because these are already very advanced insight stages that I'm talking about, there isn't very much left to do. There are very important steps left to do, but not that much. The long aspect of practice has already been done by that time. When we can see the danger in all that, that it arises constantly to impede and signify something for us, that it, there's something going on all the time which we have to react to, that we have to deal with, that we have to confront. When we see that, the terror subsides, because we can see that that terror was actually justified. We no longer think this was a crazy idea or anything like that, but we can see, yes, this is justified. It is, this is the way it is. I actually had a true experience. At such times, one should have a teacher, because one can become extremely upset by it. This practice of pure insight can be extremely upsetting. And the mind, the very few minds that will actually go along this way, because the mind will balk at all these insights. The pure insight way has a lot of dukkha in it. And that's why the Buddha again and again recommended it, to go through at least first and second jhana, to give the mind this balance of happiness, so that this terror and danger is nothing, the terror doesn't arise, but the danger is seen as something, as just a natural thing, because the mind's quite happy to see the danger. It doesn't have any particular objection to seeing it. So now the terror has subsided, and we have seen the danger in all formations. We are absolutely clear on it, that there is nothing to be gained by being here. And that's when the desire for deliverance arises. And that is the most significant point in the insight meditation, in the insight arising, whether through pure insight or through the absorption and then the insight, doesn't matter which way. It comes to that point. The only thing we leave out when we do the absorption is the terror. The everything else we have to do also. So we come to this point where the desire for deliverance arises. This desire for deliverance means we have seen quite clearly that existence has nothing to offer. Up to that time, most people, whether consciously or subconsciously, have thought that it would be quite sufficient if at least they wouldn't have to be reborn in any of the lower realms, or possibly could get a rebirth in one of the higher realms, in the Deva realms. People think about the Deva and the Brahma realms as something like paradise, and so it would be very nice to go to paradise. But at this time, whether one has thought this or not, it is quite clear that existence is always fraught with that same pressure, with that same pressure for mind and body, whatever kind of body one may be having. So the desire for deliverance has with it what is called in Pali samvega. Samvega is a very important aspect of one's mental makeup. It means urgency, to do it now. And procrastination is its enemy. And the Buddha coined it in this phrase. He said, coined this phrase for that. He said, life is very uncertain, death is very certain. We don't know how long we're going to be here. It's not a matter of age. Anybody can die at any time. I know myself, several people, who are over 90 years old and hale and hearty. And I know others who recently died at the age of 30 and even younger. And I think we all know such people. So we have absolutely no guarantee that we're going to be here. And the urgency arises when the desire for deliverance arises, when we have seen the danger in all existence. That there is nothing to be found, whether through the senses or through the mind or through the body, that can give satisfaction, full and total fulfillment. It can give only momentary pleasure. And by that time we have long seen that momentary pleasure does not answer our quest. Because at this time, what arises is disenchantment. Now, disenchantment is a conglomeration of the knowing the danger, the desire for deliverance. Disenchantment means we have seen what exists as no longer enchanting us. It is there. It can give pleasant feeling. There's no gainsaying that. Pleasant feeling is just as impermanent as unpleasant feeling. And that's why when we do the meditative absorptions, we realize that these pleasant feelings that can arise there have already disappeared the minute the meditation is over. So you can see again and again or how much easier it is to work with the absorptions, and it doesn't have to be all eight. The first one already gives one a different quality of experience. So when we have disenchantment, which is called nibbida in Pali, we have come to the significant time in our practice. This is, so to say, the last item on the inside path. That what comes after brings us to the other shore. Now, this disenchantment, at that time, we have a sort of automatic investigation of all that we see. And looking into the three characteristics, whether they actually are true in everything. It is not something deliberate at that time, because the mind has gone through this, possibly through the terror, and seen the danger, and has had the desire for deliverance. It now reflects whether it is really so, whether that all that has happened, namely, wanting to get out, really wanting to get out, and having this urgency to get out. It now wants to reflect and make sure that what it has understood so far is correct. And by wanting to do that, it keeps on reflecting on the three characteristics: impermanence, dukkha, and no self or corelessness. And it keeps on reflecting in oneself, in other people, in all that one finds around one. Sometimes the mind goes to the elements, to the primary elements, but it has a sort of quality about it at that time, the mind, that it is not easily fooled anymore into believing that that what is happening around is valuable, important, and needs to continue. Because at that time, the mind is so imbued with this desire for deliverance and the urgency to do it, and has gone through a very difficult time with terror and danger, that it really wants to make sure whether it has done it right. Now, of course, the teacher can say, yes, yes, it's right, it's fine, but that doesn't really do the main work. It is supportive and it is helpful if one has a teacher on hand that will say that. But the real work has to be done by oneself. And this is one of the most, to me anyway, fascinating aspects of this teaching. It's a complete do-it-yourself job. Nobody can do anything for anybody. The only thing that we get is a map and signposts, and we can get the instruction, but the doing is all for ourselves. So when we can, when the mind investigates these three characteristics all the time, it naturally comes to the understanding, yes, it's true. There is nothing else to be found except this impermanent nature of whatever one looks at. Everything that we can look at has impermanent nature. Everything that we can look at can therefore not be totally fulfilling, because it won't stick around, it won't stay around, it disappears again. And because it is impermanent and not fulfilling, there can't be any core substance in it. Because if it is impermanent, where is its substance? What happens to it? Naturally, it's most important to find that in oneself, but it is also very often the case that one investigates all that what is around one. Then it depends which one of the three one is most interested in. All three are interconnected. A person who has a lot of faith and confidence usually tries to work with impermanence, because it is something that the mind can not only grasp easily, but it is something that is so prominent in the teaching, and the confidence which has arisen in the teaching brings the mind automatically to impermanence. A person who has a great deal of concentration usually likes to work with dukkha. And a person who is more on the wisdom side likes to usually work with corelessness, substancelessness. And when we like to work, for instance, with the latter, with the corelessness, it is our own five khandhas, which are our kamatana. The kamatana is the a ground of investigation, our working ground, like our workshop, kamatana. Kamatana is also the meditation subject, but it's also our working ground. So if we want to work with the substancelessness, the egolessness, the non-self, the void, whatever you like to call it in English, it doesn't matter, we get at our five khandhas and we investigate each one and see whether we can find in it anything that has an enduring core, an enduring substance in it. Is there something that is enduring in the body and in the four aspects of mind? Sense consciousness, feeling, perception, and the thought processes. These are the four aspects of mind. Is there anything to be found of an enduring nature? Again and again at this time, when disenchantment has arisen, this is the investigative procedure, because the mind wants to make absolutely sure that that what it has already resolved to do is correct. It has already seen that everything dissolves, but because that was also connected with a great deal of dukkha, now in its calm state of disenchantment, it wants to renew that understanding. And it is necessary, because only when we have that understanding within us, over and over again, will it become part of our nature. Only when we have investigated time and time again and come to the same conclusion that there is nothing and nobody who owns any of the khandhas, there's no core, no substance, that all is void, that we then come to the point where this is really our inner being, that we can relate to that at any time we want to. And this is also important to know, that the mind will have in it where it turns to. When it turns to cooking, it will have cooking in it. When it turns to gardening, it will have gardening in it. But when it turns to true nature and has already gained this insight, it will know no substance. So, which means that in one's daily activities, the primary aspect of mind is mindfulness. Bear attention. But on the inside path, the mind deals with that which it has already seen as truth. And the mind needs a lot of convincing. It's got to see it again and again. It isn't very common, and certainly not mentioned in the Buddha's teaching, that liberation or freedom arises like a flash. It's a slow and arduous process. It's slow and arduous, and sometimes tedious, and sometimes appears to make no progress at all, just seems to be sitting there like a dead duck. And other times, it seems to progress quite quickly, so quickly that one would like to step back from it and say, no, wait a minute, not so fast. I'm not quite ready for all this. But one can't do that. It depends entirely upon karmic conditions. It depends on determination. Depends on a lot of outer factors. But eventually, practicing will bring the mind to this point. This point, disenchantment, nibbida, is the last step on the practice path. The next step is already the culmination of practice. The investigation can be called contemplation, it can be called introspection, it can be done at any time. It can be done during the meditation, it can be done while watching the ocean, it can be done while even just walking. Whenever the mind wants to turn to true nature, it will then reflect upon it, because it has already a lot of momentum to do that. And this momentum is one of the very important aspects for the next step. But I will talk about that tonight. Not too much all at once. And I hope that you have listened with your heart so that you can have the questions that come from heart and mind. Questions are important, very important. And they should contain one's own inner understanding. And they also are, of course, to be a help on the path. They're supposed to help on the path. Nothing that doesn't help one on the path can really be important at this point.